Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
So we're continuing our series on faith and doubt. We opened up last week on Easter Sunday talking about how we all have doubts and that doubt is a part of life. It's a part of how God has created everything in the sense that we looked last week about how doubt is not the opposite of faith, certainty is. And if you're unfamiliar with that, unclear with that, look into last week's message and look at how that anytime there's a context for faith, there's also the same context for doubt. I mean, if you know everything, if you have certainty about something, there's no room for faith. The very fact that you have a doubt about something is the necessary context for faith to happen. And we talked about how doubt's not a bad thing, but what I'm going to talk about this week is that doubt isn't a bad thing. It's just not a good place to finish. It's an okay starting place, but it's not a good finishing place. And doubt can push you to want to know more and learn more. But doubt also has the ability to paralyze you, to not want to do anything and just kind of opt for no choice, kind of as Barry Schwartz gets into. And that's, by the way, every time I watch that TED Talk with him talking about the paralysis of choice, I die laughing because I've seen a lot of TED Talks and I've never seen anybody look like they just walked in from mowing the yard to give a TED Talk. And I want to know, I want to call the guy up and say, did you lose your luggage? Is that like, what? Too many choices of what to wear that day. And so he just wore what he had on. That's a great, I haven't heard that one. Maybe he couldn't figure out which suit to wear. So it got time and he just had to get up there. I don't know what happened, but really, it just cracks me up. So he writes this book called A Paradox of Choice, and in there he talks about how whenever we're faced with too many options, we get to the point where we just can't decide, and so we don't make any choice. And he talks in there about how this really is a problem, especially when you consider that the things you need to make a choice on sometimes are things that really, really matter, and the things that have live consequences if you don't make a choice. And we think to ourselves, I don't want to make a choice because I don't want to make the wrong choice. And here's what happens with this, is that we begin to believe that there's a right choice out there. And if I don't make the right choice, I'm going to look like an idiot. And in his book, he talks about how back in the day, you'd go to the store and there used to be only one pair of jeans you could buy, right? You need a pair of jeans, you could go to the store and buy jeans. That's just they were jeans. Some of you still have that one pair of jeans. But now in the 21st century, there's multiple kinds of jeans. There's different colors of jeans, styles of jeans, fits of jeans, because there's all different kinds of body shapes and styles. And so 30 years ago, if you bought a pair of jeans and they didn't look good on you, it wasn't your fault, was it? I mean, that's just the only option. I mean, everybody wears jeans. That's what jeans look like on everybody. But now if you get a pair of jeans and they don't make you look good, whose fault is that? It's yours. Because the reason they don't look good on you is because you bought the wrong kind of jeans, right? Because there's baggy jeans and loose-fitting jeans and straight-leg jeans and relaxed jeans. And I think there's something called skinny jeans, but I don't really think there should be something called like that for guys. Just saying, moving on there. And I got to let you know, I tell Alex this all the time. I am so glad, Alex, that you are a worship leader and you don't wear skinny jeans. Because it is hard to find a worship leader these days who doesn't own a pair of skinny jeans. And just, Alex, thank you. Thank you. On behalf of all of us, thank you. Thank you. We appreciate that. And it's one thing we're talking about jeans or mutual funds. Remember, he talked about how the more mutual funds is offered, the less people make a choice on where to invest, so they just don't invest anything. Think about the stakes, as he mentioned there. What about if it's a decision you got to know for all eternity? And he shows that Far Side cartoon there where the devil asks you ranch, blue cheese, or Thousand Island. You know, this is your decision for all eternity. And he ends with that little side statement. He says, you know, you better make sure if it's going to affect you for all eternity. Well, that's what we talk about every week in here, is a decision that will affect you for all eternity. It's no wonder most people opt for doubt and just don't make a decision, and they feel like there's some sort of comfort in being an agnostic or just not deciding because I don't want to look like an idiot. It's kind of like an election year. Who's the most intelligent voter in election year? The undecided, right? There's the mindless robots who follow the Democratic Party no matter what they say or do. And then over here, there's the mindless robots who follow the Republican Party no matter what they say or do. But the real intelligent ones, the darlings of the media, are the undecided voters. I'm going to wait and weigh all the options. You know who the undecided voter votes for? Nobody. You know why? So they can look back 2 years later and go, that's why I didn't vote for Bush. He was an idiot. And they can look back 2 years later and go, that's why I didn't vote for Obama. He was an idiot. And no matter who, no matter what, no matter where things go, they made their wise choice, right? They just didn't vote because they're all a bunch of crooks anyway, right? So wisdom leads me to that. And you're like, no, you didn't even participate. You know, at least I can respect somebody who participates. Now, when it comes to religion and faith, and is there a God, is there not a God, or who is God? Are there any more options available to you in any other category than when it comes to religion or faith? I submit not. I mean, really. I mean, you can go to the Hindu religion and there's a million gods to choose from. You just pick which one you want to invest your life into. I mean, you got Shinto and Buddhism and Taoism and Sikhism. You've got Islam and you've got Judaism and then you got Christianity. And even within these different groups, I mean, there's Shia Muslims and then there's Sunni Muslims. And then within the Judaism, there's conservative Jews and liberal Jews and Hasidic Jews. There's Jews who won't drive a car on Saturday and Jews who will drive a car on Saturday. I mean, you got every different thing. And then in Christianity, we call them denominations. And then within denominations, there's sub-denominations. Do you know that? See, I'm a religious mutt. I mean, you name a denominational group, I probably have some connection with it. I've joined that. I've been a part of that. I got saved through them. I went to a camp there. I served on staff there. You name it, I'm kind of there, which is why we are a essential church. We focus on the essentials. And after all of that, I said, you know, there is one core doctrine all these groups have in common, and that's what we're going to focus our time and our energy on here at Essential, and that is the one true thing that somebody needs to know to get you from this life into the next, and that's what we focus on week after week after week. However, when I had to choose a seminary, I couldn't put off that choice for too long. I had to choose a seminary. I went with a Baptist seminary simply because I knew what they believed for the most part, and I knew that they were really good at teaching the Bible, and that's really what I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn about teaching the Bible. Well, upon like getting there, I found out, do you know how many different kinds of Baptists there are? 63 as of when I went to seminary. 63. Heinz only gives you 57 varieties. The Baptist will give you 63. There's Landmark Baptist and Primitive Baptist and Free Will Baptist. I always wonder, what's the opposite of a Free Will Baptist? I don't know. There's American Baptist and then Southern Baptist. I mean, you just keep on going on the list. It seems like every time somebody had a disagreement, they just split and made their own group. Just kind of the way we do things, I guess. So when it comes to making a choice on this, we look at all these different options, and the thought occurs to you, somebody's right and somebody's wrong. And I don't want to get things with God wrong. So I don't want to commit. In the same way that the person looks at mutual funds and they say, well, I don't want to invest in this mutual fund with my retirement, and then a year later find out that this one that I invested only did 5%, and there was one out there that did 40%. I'm going to feel like an idiot if I do that. So I just won't decide. And what have you done? You got 0%. On top of that, you lost your employer's matching contribution. And so we do the same thing, though, with religion, with God. We go, well, somebody's wrong here. I can't commit, and I don't want to be a little wrong in any area, so I'm just not going to commit. And that sounds like a good idea. Or is it? Well, one guy comes along and he says, that's a great idea. And this was a guy named William Clifford. And he wrote an essay called The Ethics of Belief. And he says, it is wrong everywhere for anyone to believe anything on the grounds of insufficient evidence. So he writes this essay, very influential essay, which says it's wrong for anybody at any time to ever believe anything on insufficient evidence. In other words, don't make a choice until you can know for sure. Sounds like good advice, right? Well, in the context of this, he was really talking about God, and he was talking about faith. And where he comes out and he says, you know, the wise decision in a situation where you can't know for certain is to just don't decide, don't commit, abstain, and opt for doubt. And that sounds really wise. However, a few years, and by the way, it was after that the term agnostic was coined. It was from this essay that we believe is where they trace the idea of being an agnostic, because it sounds really wise. That, you know, I'm just not really sure. There's a lot of issues there. A lot of things with Christianity I don't really quite believe, don't really add up. So I'm just, you know, I'm undecided right now. I'm going to choose a political party. I'm not really going to choose a retirement investment account. I'm weighing my options. I'm taking the intelligent round. I'm not really going to choose on the God thing. I'm just going to wait, see if I can find out some more information. Another guy, William James, comes along and he says, you know, that may sound like a wise decision, but it's really not. And here's why. Whenever these things are present, it's a really bad decision to make no decision. And he says, here's the three things. When these three conditions are met, it's bad to have no decision. Number one is when you have options. Number two is when the stakes of what you choose are momentous. And number three is when you are forced to make a choice. Now, there are some things in life you don't have to choose. I mean, you don't have to choose a political party. You don't have to. It doesn't matter. But there are things in life where you have to choose. You have to choose what you are going to do because the decision will be forced on you. It's kind of like the old conductor on a train says, when we come up on the next stop, you can just stay on or you can get off. You can choose to get off here and enjoy your day here in the Magic Kingdom at this part of the park, or you can stay on. However, if you do not decide what you will do at this station, the decision will be made for you. For by not getting off, you will have chosen to stay on this train. And the next stop will be Tomorrowland. When we get to Tomorrowland, you have a choice there. You can get off Tomorrowland or you can stay on. If you decide you do not want to choose, that is okay, because the decision will be made for you. We will continue on over to Fairyland or whatever the next land is. And that's the way life is when it comes to God. Death does not allow you the freedom to put this decision off. And while your mind craves the freedom and the time to spend carrying out and weighing out all the options, your life and your mortality will not give you and allow you that same freedom. You have to make a choice about what you believe will happen after this life. And you do have options. And the stakes are momentous. So James would counter Clifford's argument and say, this is not a time to sit around and not make a choice. Because if you don't make a choice, the choice will be made for you. No choice is a choice. The train of your life is moving towards death, whether you want it to or not. And you have options about what to believe. So you need to make a choice. It's kind of like he compares this idea to the guy who's in a burning building. And the building's about to burn up, and he's on the third floor. And he's got to do something. Otherwise, I mean, if he stays where he's at, he will die in the burning building. And so he looks out the window, and down below, there are some people who've come out of a pub, and they pulled out a bed sheet, and they stretch it out, and they say, jump! And at that moment, it is not a good idea, James would say, to be an agnostic. The failure to choice is not a really wise choice, and you could easily make the argument, and you could picture, you know, the agnostic up there going, I don't know whether or not they're going to be able to catch me or not. Could you all tell me how much each one of you bench presses? I need to know if you're going to be strong enough to catch me. I noticed you came out of the pub. Have any of y'all been drinking? Could you take a breathalyzer or something? Because I'm not going to jump, and you know, knowing one of you guys might be a little shifty. And speaking of a little shifty, just how committed to this cause are you? Are you going to bail? Are you going to like pull a Lucy with the football when I jump out? Are you going to get scared that I might hit you and run away? Could we do some psych evals and make sure you guys are really in this thing? And that bed sheet, what's the per cal on that thing? What's the tensile strength? Could somebody, you know, could some physicists come out here and just measure? Because I got to know, I weigh, you know, 200 pounds. If I jump, is that thing going to be able to catch me from the height of the, speaking of which also, could somebody got some physics calculator knowing that we accelerate at a speed of 9.8 feet per second? How fast will I be going when I hit that? And can that bed sheet really hold me? Now, what's going on as I'm thinking all these things? Yeah. I mean, you're starting to look like Yosemite Sam saying, my biscuits are burning, right? You don't have the opportunity to do all that. You look and say, I'm in a burning building. I've got an option. William James would say, I suggest you take that option. Just like everybody in the crowd is saying what? Jump! Jump. Now, if you're on the 105th floor, take all the time you want. You know, I mean, really, just take all the time you want. But if you're on the third floor and you have options, agnosticism is not a good choice. So some would say, okay, well, I've got to make a choice. What if I just choose not to believe in anything? What if I just believe there isn't a God? Well, first of all, let's just admit that is a faith choice. To choose that there is no God, to believe that there is no God, is in itself a faith choice. One of the leading atheists in the country, or sorry, in the world right now, he's over in England, is a guy named Richard Dawkins. Dawkins is an atheist, and he comes out about his atheism and talks about how he will not opt for the faith option of God. And he says instead this, I cannot know for certain. There we are again. Of course, you don't know for certain, so what are we in the realm of? We're in the realm of faith and doubt. So he admits at the beginning, we're in the realm of faith and doubt because I cannot know for certain. And so it says, but I think God is improbable and I will live my life on the assumption that he is not there. And let me ask you, is that a faith choice? God's improbable and I'm going to assume he's not there? He doesn't have any certainty about this. He admits he doesn't have any certainty about it. So he's placing his faith in the belief that there is no God. Now, to place your faith in the belief there is no God, I love the way Norman Geisler just titles his book. He says, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. It takes more faith, in my opinion, to be an atheist than it does to believe that there is a God, an intelligent creator. For instance, if you were to go to Mount Rushmore, how much faith would it take you to believe that the faces on Mount Rushmore were carved there by natural occurrences? That the wind and the rain and meteorites or whatever, you know, the eagles, the birds, the animals, whatever, all that stuff beat against those rocks and carved out the faces that happened to resemble four presidents? Who in the room will join me in the belief that that happened by natural occurrences? Anyone? Does that sound like a stupid decision? Would you be an idiot for believing that? However, somehow, some way, we've convinced ourselves in society that while it is impossible that rocks would be formed into the shape of the faces of four presidents, carbon molecules, atoms, biological ingredients could by accident be shaped in the very things that inspired those creative pieces. The very face of George Washington, they would say, is a mere accident. Just happened by time and chance. Now let me ask you, which is more of a dynamic thing? A rock in the shape of a face, or a living, breathing, fleshly, animate object with a soul and a mind that inspired that rock carving? Which would it take more faith, that the rock could be carved into that, or that the human face and form could be carved out of nothing by its own design and by its own chance without an intelligent creator could have done it? You go to a rock and you say, obviously somebody created that. How can you then look in the mirror and say, random chance? Now, maybe some of y'all feel like that when you wake up in the morning. So, Geister would just on that alone, would just say, I don't have enough faith to believe when I look in the mirror, that was all random chance. And that gets us to John chapter 6 and the kind of the setting in the background for John chapter 6, understanding what Peter says in response to Jesus in John chapter 6. John chapter 6 takes place right after Jesus has fed 5,000 people or so with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. In this day in society and culture, most people are day laborers, which we don't really fully understand in America. Basically, what this means is that when you wake up in the morning, you have $0 to your name. You go and you work all day from sunup to sundown in the hopes that you will earn enough money at the end of the day, you'll get paid. So you can go to the marketplace on the way home and buy enough money or buy enough food for dinner for you and your family. Maybe have something left over for breakfast the next morning or maybe lunch. And then you go out and you do the exact same thing the next day. It's a day labor. You make just enough money that day to earn enough money to buy your food for the next day, which is why when Jesus gives the Lord's Prayer, what does he say? Give us this day our daily bread. And that means something in that culture. So they don't have a Dave Ramsey $1,000 savings fund, anything. They've got enough money for one day. So if you took the day off of work because you were so enamored and enthralled with the teaching that Jesus was giving, and then at the end of that day, Jesus feeds you for free, you're thinking to yourself, hey, I kind of like that. No work, free food, hang out. And there's, you know, lazy bums weren't invented in the 20th and 21st century. That's like age old. So they go and they track down Jesus and they go, hey, we want some more free food. And this is a great sermon for today, because I know the only reason why you all came this morning is because you heard there was free frozen yogurt after the service. You're like, hey, I thought we were getting frozen yogurt. Where was it? I was waiting for a way. You'll get on your way out. Just calm down. Just calm down. Jesus looks at him and he's like, you guys aren't here because you care about why I'm here. If you want to go find it, it is there. You don't even want to wait. That's fine. That's cool. Let's go. He has no idea. I just joked him. Sorry, whoever he was, I'm sorry. If he was a visitor or whatever, I didn't see who he was. I didn't even see his face. But anyways, I just can't wait. It is down there. If you got to get up and go, you can go get it now and come back later. So Jesus says, you guys aren't here because you care about what I'm teaching. You're just a bunch of lazy bums looking for free food and free frozen yogurt. And so Jesus decides he's going to kind of have a little fun with them, so to speak. He says, you want food? You want some free food? Okay, how about this? I'm the food. I'm the bread that comes down from heaven. You want some free bread? I'm it. And he says to him, I am the bread of life. Now keep in mind, when we read this, we quote this verse at communion. We know what he's talking about here. We know if you were at the Passover service on Thursday night just about a week or so ago, you know the context of this, what Jesus is referring to. They don't have that benefit. Jesus has never gotten up in the middle of the Passover service and said, this bread which was taken, broken, and hidden, which we thought represented Isaac, the son who was going to be slain but wasn't slain because the lamb was provided. I'm that lamb. I'm giving you a really quick overview of what happened on that Thursday night when you were here. I talk really, really fast, so if you want to hear it, you need to go next year on that Thursday night. He says, I am this bread. This bread has always represented me in my body, which is broken for you and for your sins. And this cup of redemption, this cup that's always been a part of the Passover meal, the third cup of the four, this cup is the cup of redemption, which we represent right here with this bread and this cup. We know that now. But they didn't know that then. So Jesus says to them, you want some free bread? Here it is. I'm the bread of life that's come down from heaven. Your ancestors, they ate manna in the wilderness, and yet they died. But right here in front of you, me, myself, I'm the bread that comes down from heaven. And anyone may eat of me, and not die. I'm the living bread. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for life to the world. And they're looking at that going, ew. Straight up, that was their response. I mean, it sounds like he's saying, you got to be a cannibal to be with me here. And then if that wasn't sick enough, just to kind of have some more fun with them now, he goes on and he says, very truly I tell you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood. I mean, is anybody getting some weird Ozzy Osbourne Halloween sort of deal here? How many of y'all were grossed out by Ozzy Osbourne back in the day? And y'all are thinking, you're comparing Jesus to Ozzy Osbourne? When these people heard it, it's exactly what it sounded like to them. It sounded like an Ozzy Osbourne concert to them. They didn't get it. I don't know where else you're going to get that comparison and be able to get off with that on a Sunday morning, but it fits. It works, right? You're just as repulsed by Ozzy Osbourne biting the head off a rat and drinking the blood as they were the idea of a human being standing before you saying, you need to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And so what do you think happens? They're pretty much like, I'm out of here. Forget this. It says, from this time, many of the people who were following him turned their back and followed him no longer. There was a big crowd. There were 5,000 people there just yesterday. And so of that group of 5,000 comes back and finds him. He tells him, you got to eat my blood, drink my blood and eat my flesh. They're kind of like, yeah, this didn't really go the way we wanted. And they start walking away. And then Jesus looks at the 12. Says, y'all don't want to leave too, do you? And I don't know what was happening. I just kind of picture like everybody kind of dispersing and like the disciples were like, kind of wandering over. And then I was just like, hey, where are you guys going? No, I wasn't going nowhere. I had the thing with the person and the thing going on. Look at the time. My wife's laundry? What? I wasn't going anywhere. No, I was just looking for something over here. So he's like, you don't want to leave too, do you? And in the midst of that, Peter just kind of speaks on behalf of them, and he just says this. He says, Lord, to whom shall we go? You got the words of life, and we've come to believe and know that you're the Holy One of God. Right there, that's a faith statement in the midst of uncertainty. Peter didn't say, hey, I'm cool. You want me to eat your blood or drink your blood, eat your flesh? That's cool, whatever, you know. That's right, whatever. It doesn't matter to me. Yeah, I'm game. I'm down. Just, you know, let's eat right now. No, he's looking at Jesus going, I don't get this. This is a little crazy to me. But I'm not really sure what other option I got. Where else am I going to go? You know, I've looked at all the other options out there. I've considered everything else. And I don't really know where I'd go. You see, here's the deal. We convince ourselves or get convinced that I got questions that aren't answered with Christianity. So I can't commit until I get these questions answered. And so we go looking everywhere else to get an answer to these questions. You know what you find? You find less answers out there than you ever did with Christianity. Okay, so you're not really sure about what happens after you die because you're not really sure you can trust what the Bible says. Where else are you going to go looking for answers? From an 8-year-old kid who says he went there and came back? Not knocking the movie or anything like that, but seriously, why do you think it's such a big thing? Because we're searching for answers to this. You can go to the atheist point of view. They'll simply tell you, well, nothing happens after you die. And I always say, well, explain to me, why is it when I go to a funeral, I can't help but sit there and think to myself, I'm going to see this person again? You may say, well, you know, I'll go out there. I don't have an answer to this, but where else am I? Peter's like, where else am I going to go to find meaning and purpose in life? There is no meaning or purpose outside of God. And if you ask an atheist, they'll tell you. And if they're honest atheists, they've really thought the thing through, they'll tell you there isn't an answer. Dawkins himself says, science has now answered every question that humanity has ever proposed or ever has haunted the human soul, except for a few meaning and trivial things like meaning and purpose. Excuse me? Did you just say it's a trivial thing to have a need for meaning or purpose in life? I'm sorry. All of humanity wants to know what's the point. And you're telling me that's meaningless? You know, even if you go from a scientific point of view, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 3 says, by faith, we've come to understand that the universe was formed by God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. We believe that by faith, that God created something out of nothing. We believe that by faith. You know what science's answer is for the creation of something out of nothing? There isn't one. Zero answer, nothing. There is no answer. There is no scientific explanation, period. And if you go to the scientific belief of evolution as how we got here, you go back to first cause, there is no answer for first cause. There is no answer for how the earth ended up in the perfect place. I love one of the videos I've shown in the past. You know how the earth got put on the perfect tilt for life to form? The magical asteroid knocked us off center perfectly at the perfect position for us to be where we could sustain life in the seasons. And even the author goes, a miraculous asteroid. I'm like, whoa, you don't have room for miracles in the scientific realm. You can't go to that. You can't say the word like it was designed. You can't go there. You can't steal my design word if you're going to believe in evolutionary thought. You can't believe there's life after this death if you go to evolutionary thought. You have less answers in science than you ever did with faith, which I think is interesting because in science, they would say this, is whenever you're looking for what the theory you should believe in science, it says, does this theory lead me to believe or understand or expect the things to happen that happen? So if I believe there is no God, would I expect the things that happened to have happened? No. Because nothing never creates something. And things do not go from less order to more order. They go from order to disorder. You don't have all the parts of a junkyard miraculously turn into a car. You don't have a mountain miraculously get turned into a face. It just doesn't happen. But if you leave that face there untouched, in a million years from now, you won't see that face there anymore. Because things go from order to disorder. Does science explain how we got here? No. So if you're going to leave Christianity because you've got some questions that aren't answered, just know you're going to be going to some other belief system that's going to answer far less than Christianity will. And science ironically says, whenever you're faced with theories that are incomplete, we should choose the one that has the greatest explanatory power. In other words, the belief system that makes the most things make sense is the one you should opt for. I challenge you to look to science or any other world faith for a greater explanatory power for how you got here, why you are here, where you came from, what happens after you die, the formation of matter, how marriage works, how to be a better parent. I challenge you to find any other belief system that will get more of your questions. Why do you have a need for love? Why do you love? Where does love come from if we all evolved to get here? What is hope? Why do you have a need for hope? Why do you have something to believe in? Why even need for God if there is no God? What has the greatest explanatory power for all these life questions that we all have that are universal? I come back and say it's Christianity. Peter's sitting there looking at Jesus going, I don't understand this whole flesh and blood thing. Where else am I going to go, man? I've seen too much. You just fed 5,000 people with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. I don't have an explanation for that either. We walked up to a tomb of a dead guy and you said, Lazarus, come on out. Like you were just waking up a sleeping kid. I never seen that before. I don't understand this whole flesh and blood thing. But I've seen too much to walk away. And I've looked at the other options. And some of you, you have that testimony. Here's what's going to happen. If you decide you're not going to believe in Jesus, you're not going to believe in God, you're going to go out there and you're going to be forced to make value decisions every single day based on what you believe. Your morals and your ethics will be all based on what you believe about whether there is or isn't a God, because your default, the default of the human heart is I'm God. I will make up my decisions for what I believe is right or wrong. And what happens with an entire world where everybody says, I will make a decision for myself what is right or wrong? Anybody want to live in that world? So some would say, well, then I will choose the morality of the populace. I will allow Congress to make the decisions of morality for me. Anybody comfortable with that group of people setting the moral standard for life, really? That's what you're going to look to for your moral standard? Is that really a better option when you think about it? This is the same country that decided that people who were of a different skin color than you were only worth 2/3 and were property. This is the same, you know, government that at one point says women aren't smart enough to vote. Really? You're going to let that group of people decide your morality and the morality of the populace is going to be what you determine what is right and wrong? Really? Doesn't sound like a very good idea to me. But you're going to make decisions every single day about good and better, right and wrong. And it's all going to be shaped by what you believe about whether there is or isn't a God. Once again, as William James says, you've got options. you're forced to make a choice, and the consequences are momentous. They're very, very, very important. So you don't have the luxury of not making a choice, because by not making a choice, you've decided you are your own God. And Peter says, I've been there, I've done that. I've tried to live life as if I was my own God. I've tried to follow other teachings and beliefs about life, but where else am I gonna go? Jesus, you're the only one that has any explanation that makes any sense to me. And I still got questions. I still got some doubts. I still got some things I don't understand. But you're the best option going. So when it comes to the major issues of uncertainty about life and what lies beyond life into death, I don't really see I have any other options. So Jesus, I'm placing all of my faith and all of my hopes in you. And this Jesus, he places his faith and hope in, eventually would go to a cross, die on the cross, spend 3 days in a tomb, and come out alive. I don't see anybody else doing that. You know, one of the most convincing proofs to me is the life of James. James was Jesus' half-brother. If you look at James and Jesus' relationship before Jesus' death on the cross and resurrection, James thought his brother was a nut. As a matter of fact, one time he tries to go and get his brother committed. It's like, you're crazy, we're bringing you home, we're putting an end to this whole Messiah thing. No, they're gonna commit you to the loony bin or kill you. For your own good, Jesus, we're taking you home. That same guy, James, who thought his brother was an idiot and a loon, after Jesus' resurrection, it says that Jesus appeared to his brother. And it says in there, Jesus walked up to him and said, "How you like me now?" Well, I don't know what Jesus said, it's not in the text. But that's how I picture it going down. Because I know that's what I would do, and I always assume Jesus would do what I would do. Anyways. Hey, I'm just saying what you all believe, right? But here's what I do know for true. This is legit. His brother, who thought he was a loon, ends up becoming the lead pastor of the Christian movement at the lead church in Jerusalem, okay? On top of that, he writes a letter to the entire world which says, "My name is James. And I am the servant, I am the slave of Jesus, who is God." That's how he opens up his letter. What would it take for you to write a letter to the world saying that your brother is God and you're his slave? Just honest question. I think it would take watching him die on a cross and come back to life. Sold, done, right there. I'm in, both feet. James actually gets beheaded for this belief. Yeah. I would say there's something there. That's worth me saying, you know, I don't have all my questions answered with Christianity. I still got doubts and I still got these issues that don't make any sense to me. But as I look at the options, agnosticism, you don't have that luxury. Atheism, I don't have faith for that. Any other belief system that tries to explain life, not there. Science, give me a break. I still got questions, Jesus, but I'm gonna place all my faith in you for what lies beyond this life. My hope, my prayer, my ask during this series is you would too. Would you join with me as we close? Father, as we close out this morning, may we really do some careful thought this afternoon on our way home in the car and really ask ourselves, have we really thought through this, or are we just trying to act smart and say, I need to know more information. I still got doubts, I can't commit. Father, the reality of the situation is we live in a context of faith and doubt. We cannot know for certain. But Lord, we need to make a choice. Every day we're making a choice. So Father, if there's anyone in this room who has yet to decide, yet to step over that line, may this morning be the day they commit their life to you and say, God, I still have my doubts, but I place my life, my faith, my trust in you. In Jesus' name, amen. Of course, we know what Jesus meant when he said, unless you eat of my body and drink of my blood, you can have no part of me. He wasn't referring to cannibalism. What he was referring to is the table that we celebrate every single Sunday we come together as a church. And that is simply that Jesus Christ died on the cross for your sins and for mine. And he wants you to remember that and reflect on that as often as you come together. He says, do this in remembrance of me. And so we tear off a piece of bread to be reminded that Jesus Christ died on the cross for my sin. The guilt and the shame that I feel, I owe a consequence for what I've done. He says, I've paid for that consequence on the cross. So when you come together, just tear off a piece of bread, just know that my body was broken for you. And then we take it, we dip it in the cup, just to be reminded that his blood was shed for us. It was a cup of redemption. And he says, that's my blood which is being shed for you for the forgiveness of your sins. And so every single week we share that, we talk about that. If God's put something on your heart that you need to spend time in prayer with him about, I just ask that you can do that right where you're sitting as Alex leads us in worship, or you can come up to the altar and do that, or if you want to pray with myself or Pastor James, we're here to pray with you. My hope is that you realize a decision is being made for you every single day. And this morning might be a day you take that one big step of faith and say, God, I don't have all my questions answered, but I trust you. I find it hard to believe that you'd forgive me, but I'm going to take a risk on this. I'm going to come up, I'm going to tear off a piece of bread and dip it in the cup as acknowledgement that you died for my sins. And so I ask that you come and respond however he's laid upon your heart to do so.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.